The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
Joined by Pat Rabbit, former leader of the Labour Party and chairman of TUSLA, John Cunningham, relationship director with Morgan McKinley, and Christina Finn from journal.ie. Just before we get into the stories making the news this weekend, particularly that of, as the Sunday Times puts it, consultants facing HSE inquiry over cash payments, and the Mail talking about cancer care delayed because of manipulations of the NTPF. The Irish National Stud and Gardens, one of the only working stud farms in the world that's open to the public, has given us a prize for the weekend. They're in the Heart of Kildare. They're just off the M7 at Junction 13. Open 7 days a week. The National Stud is the perfect place for a family day out. You can see stallions, mares, newborn foals. And for the kids, there's a fairy trail and fairy village. You can see more on irishnationalstud.ie. And what they're giving away is a private tour of the Irish National Stud and Gardens, plus a two-night stay at the luxurious Killishy House Hotel, with breakfast on both mornings and dinner on an evening of your choice. Prizes for two adults sharing. You can text the word Kildare and your name to us now on 53106. That's 53106. Christina Finn, there's a significant trouble at Mill from the perspective of the HSE, Children's Health Ireland, and the Minister, because you now have the overlapping of the Children's Health Ireland report, which is a redacted version, apparently, we are going to see this week, and reports of the National Treatment Purchase Fund being manipulated for private profit, in essence, according to a whistleblower.
Yeah, so the Irish Daily Mail reporting on their front page that a whistleblower has claimed that he told the HSE directly that there was seriously ill patients, teenagers in particular, who were put on through unnecessary risk due to alleged abuses of the fund, saying that because they were referred to the fund that their treatment was somehow delayed. And this is sort of follows on from, I suppose, a litany of reports from the CHI. Like, first of all, we've had the scoliosis issue with the clamps and things that are putting to children's
backs. The improper
backs,
springs
and the hip dysplasia. We've had board members resign. So this is just, I suppose, a latest thing that's going to be landed on the desk of Health Minister Jennifer Carroll McNeill, who I think most people will say that, you know, she has tried to grasp this, that she was hearing from about some of these controversies when she was getting media reports and requests into her, which is just no way to operate in terms of accountability and transparency. So I think this will be one that we'll see play out over the next week if it does come to pass, in terms of perhaps we've heard, you know, within CHI reports from that unredacted report about a toxic culture within CHI. And now we're having whistleblowers come out with further stories like this. So I think it's hard to see how a clear out or some sort of restructure of CHI at this point, given that they are going to be tasked with dealing with the children's hospital whenever that is actually finally opened. It just feels that the trust at, particularly I think at high senior government level, is seriously waning.
Well,
there.
Some of the allegations that are being made by the whistleblower in respect of the National Treatment Purchase Fund are deeply worrying. Suggestions that hospital management, as the Mail puts it, actively blocked HSE staff from using rooms and equipment to artificially create waiting lists so that people would then get referred to a more expensive NTPF-funded service, and some consultants employed under the Treatment Purchase Fund working simultaneously at multiple hospitals by allegedly subcontracting out their work to other medics. I mean, if that is proven to be true, it's criminal.
And I suppose, listen, you have to think, poor old Bernard Gloucester and the minister, you know, they finish work on a Friday and they have the weekend, and every Monday morning they come in, there's another pile on the desk for them. I mean, if what's being proposed is true, I mean, I hate suggesting there needs to be an investigation, but it's actually outrageous. And you look at the scale of the National Purchase Treatment Fund, which I think was brought back in by Mary Harney back in the late 90s. It was, I think, at the time a temporary measure, but it was something to alleviate the pressure. And it's worked brilliantly well. And if it's a case, it's been undermined and abused. Again, it's another very sad reflection on the structures. And again, we keep talking about culture. Culture takes time to change, and heads need to roll if it's a case there's it's not progressing. And I don't know who has the strength, the courage to make that happen. Maybe Pat, you'd have a view, but I think certainly Jennifer Carroll McNeill is somebody who's afraid of nobody. And I think if there's that sort of dramatic change needs to take place, she's the person to do it.
Meanwhile, the Sunday Times is reporting hospital consultants who are accepting cash-only payments.
Yeah.
Like, well, I'll do it for cash, a medical treatment.
Well, you kind of think it's like Romania back in 1962. But again, there's all these allegations. As when you read that and you kind of think, it couldn't be true. And then you think, well, maybe it is, but show me the facts. To get away, remove the emotion and show, investigate it and find out. And if there are consultants saying, please pay cash, and I'm quite sure now you're going for consultants, it's 350 quid a go or whatever else, it's another outrage. Another outrage.
A spokesman for the HSE saying the audit, this is an audit commissioned by Jennifer Carol McNeill, the Minister for Health, will include a range of factors, including methodologies of payments by private patients to consultants undertaking any private consultations on site. In other words, they're going to have to check that medical consultants are doing cash only work.
I find it hard to believe, but I'm just after being advised by somebody of personal experience of being told, well, then go down and find an ATM machine and come back.
A consultant?
Yes. I find that amazing. I think, like most people, I was under the impression that the children's hospitals were doing tremendous work in difficult, cramped, inadequate spaces and so on. The people on the board of CHI slipped away without too much attention, but they were very distinguished people in their previous working lives, and so on. The notion that the fund created to alleviate pressure at the top of the waiting list, where there were excruciatingly urgent cases, that should be manipulated and actually put to a use that contravenes its original purpose, which was to give speedier access to medical care. And the implication here being the children lost out time-wise because of the manner in which it's been implemented. I must say, I still find far-fetched. It'll be interesting to see what the investigations throw up. But I agree with John, I think, Christine, I think the minister will be determined to get to the bottom of it. But I would wait to see, because some of those allegations are almost beyond belief.
But Pat, from a governance perspective, the fact that this has come through a whistleblower would indicate to me that from a governance perspective, there's some fundamental failings with regard to what's been communicated to the board, the role the directors are taking. Now, when you see a raft of people resigning from a board, Pat, and you've been around long enough to know this, the stuff going on and people feel trust is broken down. And governance, I mean, for any of us who've been involved in voluntary boards, you know, it's the three most important things are governance, governance and governance. And the fact that these things, which are material and fundamental, these are not small things. So, like, you know, these are things that appear in accounts and appear in kind of regular financial reports or complaint registers. So there's a huge governance issue here. And I think that, again, it's just lifting the lid on it for the moment.
I think there's an element as well that the surprise and, you know, people when they hear stories like this find it hard to believe, because I think sometimes, and I think there's definitely a huge group of great consultants out there that are doing absolutely stellar work. But that's not to say there aren't bad apples in every single industry that are perhaps bringing into question some of these controversies. And I just think that, you know, personally, even on the Sunday Times front page, I have heard of cases of cash payments being taken by consultants. I think to just for
did,
people.
Did
to
that come with any reasoning for the, because maybe it is, maybe, I don't know, there might have been a difficulty in
maybe
getting
the
payment
machine
processed.
Broken, who knows?
Or is it like the plumber saying, I'll do it for cash?
That seemed to be the implication that I was told personally by people, as in get cash out for the payment. So I think if there's audits like that, 100%,
and
I think that needs to be
looked at. 250,000
minimum, yeah.
Yeah, if you're paying a consultant's fee, you're definitely getting up to the 300 mark for that. So I think that definitely when we're looking at audits like this and, you know, open transparency and accountability, because I do feel that there is sometimes medical professionals, they're put on this pedestal, kind of like, I suppose, in the olden days when we did with the church and the hierarchy there. You know, people deserve to have answers and they deserve to be going to a healthcare system that is open and transparent and is run appropriately. And stories like this on the front page, be it about, you know, funds of taxpayers' money being used inappropriately, perhaps, you know, people being asked to go and get cash payments for consultants for whatever reason that is being given there. It just brings a really bad taste, I think, in people's mouth. And
it's also
and distrust, I suppose, of a healthcare system when we should be trusting of the doctors that we go
to. It also leaves you in a very worrying situation in terms of the commissioning of the new children's hospital. If this toxic infighting to which you referred is actually going on, one can only imagine what it's going to be like to bring about synergies that will make the new hospital functional immediately. And, you know, the disappearance of an experienced board that was supposed to be seized of this issue now seems to be in some chaos, so that the preparation for the opening of the new hospital could be a major disappointment in the short term. It's tragic, and it's important that it's cleared up quickly, and I presume the minister is well aware of the necessity
but,
to do so.
But what of the National Treatment Purchase Fund? Because my recollection was that this was created for a simple and important purpose, which was if you needed an operation, if there was a clogged up system here where you were on a waiting list, we would put you on a plane, fly to the UK, get you treatment. How do we end up with a situation where people are getting bounced out of treatments in Ireland, allegedly, for NTPF-funded treatments in Ireland?
My understanding of the purpose of the National Treatment Purchase Fund is exactly what you've said. You were transferred to a hospital in Northern Ireland or wherever it was possible to do it, and thus it alleviated the pressure on the waiting lists here. What seems to be coming to light here is that it is being manipulated for financial advantage, and that the original purpose of the fund is being undermined.
But even the fact that the fund is purchasing private treatment within the Irish system where treatment is already available seems to be a bizarre use of the fund, even if it isn't being manipulated. It seems to have travelled a long way from its original remit.
Yes, I think that's right. But I suspect that if manipulation there is, the reason for the transfer between local, public and private is to assist that manipulation.
But I think that, you know, the fallback of the private hospitals has always been there for the public system. And that's what we're seeing in terms of perhaps an over-reliance or a use of it that perhaps isn't necessary. But they've always had that option of utilising private hospitals.
But was the NTPF not implicitly temporary? Was it not that the idea was that this was going to solve a waiting list problem, be a quick fix, and then we would go back to a functioning system?
Sure, when have we not had a waiting list problem? This is, I suppose, the thing is the waiting list problem has not disappeared in decades. So a fund of this nature has just sort of remained in place.
But what would be fascinating would be to go back and look at the original memo and arts relating to the National Purchase Treatment Fund. It was set up for, because it was, my understanding, a temporary thing. Anything that lasts 25 years from a temporary process, a bit like direct provision of this, develop its own ecosystem, develop its own rules, it changes and evolves on an organic basis. And has anybody actually looked at it and reassessed its role? Because again, there was that huge, my understanding, huge delineation between the core health system and the National Purchase Treatment Fund, and that's what made it work. It sounds like now it's become kind of integrated and part of the problem as against part of the solution. So what's been raised...
And what, do you believe that once something survives more than about two decades, it becomes a permanent part of the system?
But absolutely, but it also becomes it becomes dysfunctional because it's not then evolving strategically, it's happening organically and responding to problems. So, you know, on the basis of what we've read today, now, some of the stuff, as I said, is really kind of quite shocking if it's true. And if it's true, there's a fundamental problem. And I don't want to keep saying governance, 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 but there's certainly a problem here that needs to be resolved.
53106, if you want to get in touch, or 087 1400 106. Other allegations that are being looked into, the Sunday Times describes them as the most serious of the allegations in the report, concerns the activities of a consultant who was paid €35,800 to run weekend clinics funded by the National Treatment Purchase Fund in breach of guidelines. And this is a consultant who is working full-time in the system anyway.
And if he's in breach of guidelines, what are the consequences? Can he be pulled up, fined or taken out?
Text saying, I have been going to various consultants for 40 years privately and never once have I been asked for cash. I can guarantee most of your listeners would say the same as I am. No wonder doctors are leaving here in their droves the way that they are treated here. Another, I think the HSE need to go back to the very basics with how money is spent, especially in the community, and start with the mileages and expenses. 53106, as I say, or 087 1400 106. The other news this weekend, or rather this morning, is that the spat between the President of the United States and his former quasi-cabinet member and world's richest man, Elon Musk, seems to be diffusing slightly because Elon Musk has deleted all of the tweets that suggested that Donald Trump was in some way in cahoots with the sex trafficker Jeffrey Epstein. Pat, do you find yourself watching this and think back to all the times that somebody said about politics in Ireland, only in Ireland would this happen? It makes us look very calm and mundane by comparison, doesn't it?
Our corruption isn't in the hip-day place. That's what Charles Jay used to say when he was under pressure. Oh, you should look at some of the South American countries and all the rest. I mean, when elephants fight, the grass tends to get trampled. And I'm afraid that the grass here are the ordinary working class people of the United States, because Trump's big bill seems to be the main focus, or one of the principal focus, of Musk. And Musk is right, of course. It will drive the debt through the roof. But Musk's solution to that is not to drop the enormous largesse being visited on the super wealthy, but rather to cut spending further and to cut Medicaid and the services for ordinary people. So in those circumstances, I mean, such reaction as there is in the Senate of opposition to the bill seems to be coming from the right. They're saying, yes, we want the tax cuts for the super wealthy, but we'll have to make cuts because this will drive the debt wild.
Yeah.
And therefore, if there are amendments to the bill, as there may well be now as a result of Musk changing sides, so to speak, it will be further imposition on working families in serious trouble in parts of the United States, who ironically supported Trump, and the wealthy again being the beneficiaries of extraordinary largesse.
But the problem there is it's not just the American working class. What he has done is turned the world order on its head, and he's created global uncertainty, which means that in every economy in the world, uncertainty leads to decisions not being made, investments not being made, and jobs not being filled. Now, we're very lucky. It looks like the Irish economy has demonstrated great resilience. I don't know if you saw the unemployment rate has gone down from 4.4% to 4%. We had that extraordinary GDP figure for the first quarter up 10%, which is all that front-loading of the pharma stuff. But the bottom line is that what they've done is created this global uncertainty that's going to affect all of us, and it's going to be immediate. Now, you know, just even coming in this morning, we could spend all day just talking about this relationship between Musk and whether he was on ketamine once a month or every day, and Donald Trump smiling at him on the ball. It is absolutely outrageous to think that where we've ended up. And the fact now that Musk is after putting out a quiz on his X platform, and 80% believe that he should set up a third party, as an example. So this is beyond the elephants trampling the grass around them. It's trampling the grass all over the world. And you have to think the Chinese are just sitting back and thinking, this is the greatest gift that has ever been handed to us.
And I assume, Christina, in this, that the concern for Trump, whether or not it takes the form of Musk starting an alternative party, it's what happens to the money that Musk was flinging at the political system, because he put $250 million into the election. If that goes in another direction, it's going to make an impact.
Yeah, and he has, I think, made previous donations to the Democrats. I saw a report today, and Katrina Perry actually has a really good piece in the Sunday Independent kind of talking about, you know, what happens when the most powerful man and the richest man in the world take the gloves off. And I think that's the big question here is, like, what does this mean for the world? And I don't think, like, it's so hard to predict what's going to come next. But I think if you're looking at talk of a new political party, like, God, we could end up anywhere in 6 months' time if that's the case. But that'll be really interesting in terms of...
Very difficult to build a real working machine across the entire
US. She's sort of talking about, could this be good news for the Democrats for, you know, for most part, I think most people are saying, where are the Democrats for the last 6 months? Yeah.
Nothing. Politics of that, Pat, James Carville at the start said, lads, keep your heads down. This is going to implode. Let them eat themselves. Don't get involved. Do you think this is strategic silence from the Democrats, politically wise strategic silence, or is it just there's nobody there to lead them?
Well, I think they've no coherent leadership or policy platform at the moment. And I think they are saying, stay out of this because this is not going to last. You know, when you talk about the corruption issue, I think the political parties in this jurisdiction get very little credit for the manner in which they cleaned up politics. There's never any credit for it. And that's what's poisoning the situation in the United States, that the capacity of oligarchs and billionaires to skew the political system is endless. And, you know, Musk was there to benefit from enormous state contracts in defence and other areas.
And the fact that that's overt, I mean, the worst of the Irish corruption was a covert attempt to do what the Americans are now doing openly. Trump saying, I will cancel your contracts if you don't support
me. It's amazing. It's just like, I mean, getting a free aeroplane from Qatar is scarcely hidden. It's about as brazen two fingers in the eye to the American public as you could get. And we're going to spend more than the plane is valued in order to make it fit for Air Force One. And then when I retire, I'm going to take it with me. I mean, it's beyond belief. I mean, it does really raise fundamental questions about the democracy being practiced as it's practiced in the United States. And unfortunately, it's affecting us already and it's likely to affect us more.
Interesting in relation, we were talking about the consultants seeking cash payments. Apparently it is more common than you might think, although a lot of people are saying it is both common and above board. I've been asked for cash recently by consultants. However, I still got a receipt and I still claimed it back. If these consultants were up to something untoward, they wouldn't be giving out receipts. One said, oh, we take cards too, when I asked about an ATM. So I imagine they're trying to get people to stop using checks. Another, my daughter's consultant always wants cash. His card machine is always not working and he sends us to the ATM to get cash. €250 each time. We have to go to him as the wait list for public is years long. Another, I was charged £200 for a 9-minute visit to tell me there was nothing wrong with my hand and he seemed surprised when I wanted a receipt as well. And another, what's wrong with paying cash to consultants as long as you are given a receipt? Well, I think that goes to the heart of the matter is whether or not people are getting receipts for these people.
The auditable process.
53106 or 087 1400 106 on WhatsApp if you want to get in touch. Coming back after the break, we will be talking about the Business Post reporting that we are now going to have a two-tier rental market where if you have a property that is an existing property, you will be allowed to charge one rent. But if you have a property which is a new build, you'll be able to charge a vastly higher one. With me, I have Christina Finn from journal.ie, John Cunningham, Relationship Director of Morgan McKinley, Pat Rabbit, former leader of the Labour Party. The Business Post reporting that in an attempt to kickstart the dormant, stalled, mordant, dead, whatever you want to call it, apartment building sector, they're going to end up with a two-tier rental market where there'll be one set of rents if you're in an existing property and another set of rents or rent rules if you're in a new build. Have I that more or less right, John?
Well, as they presented it, I think there's a sense that, one, there's lots of questions that have yet to be answered. But the bottom line is that if you're in a rent pressure zone at the moment, you will stay in that rent pressure zone until your contract expires. And in the meantime, if somebody comes in and builds new apartments, you won't be in the rent pressure zone, okay? So this is all about, because fundamentally, I've written down here.
And what that means, so that means that the landlord who has an existing property will only be allowed to increase their rent by 2% per annum maximum.
Correct.
But a new build, free rent.
Can take market value. So technically, you have an apartment in Blanchardstown, it's in the rent pressure zone, and you're unhappy or whatever else, okay, and they're paying 950 a month where the market rent is 2,300, you build a new set of apartments beside it, you can get 2,300 rent. So I suppose the question is, on the basis that one of the biggest problems with regard to building anything in this country is financing and getting access to financing, all this does at the moment is create more uncertainty and confusion. And I think Michael O'Flynn made a comment in one of the articles today, which I think is the most important thing at the moment, is that this is the 15th or 16th thing that has happened with regard to housing, okay? It doesn't appear to be connected or strategic or holistic. And you kind of get a sense, would you stop doing all the step back, tell us the story and put it all together and let us see where everything connects and makes sense. And I just wanted to say, Antoine, when I was on last, we had this big discussion about Brendan McDonagh and his 450,000 salary. I'm saying now give him 650,000 and get him in quick.
Well, Frank Kenny is quoted in this. He's the founder of Urbio, one of Ireland's largest private rental sector operators, is saying this is going to compound the housing supply deficit. Yeah. And if enacted, these proposals, a two-tier rental market, new versus legacy stock, will undermine viability and deter reinvestment, the opposite of what it is intended to achieve.
Yeah, well, I'd say the government are hoping for the complete opposite of that. They've been discussing this for a couple of weeks. It's been well flagged, I suppose, that these changes have been coming down the line. The issue, I think, for me and the concern is that the changes that they're bringing in terms of, you know, rent resets and getting away with rent pressure zones is talking about tenancy protections working in tandem on that, because there's a real risk here where landlords will be able to reset the rent after a tenancy or after somebody leaves. So the question is, you know, will this result in, you know, more evictions? People saying, sorry, I need the flat for my son or daughter and all the rest. They can reset the rent. And the concern for me is when the eviction ban was lifted, I remember Dara Bryan was out in government buildings. I was there and there was all these promises about, don't worry, we're going to protect renters, even though we're lifting the ban. We're going to bring in all these new legislative measures. We're going to give you the option. One of them was, you know, first refusal to buy the property if you're being asked to leave, that your landlord had to give you first right of refusal. New government quietly shelved, not in the programme for government. Lots of talk about delays for that over the last number of months before it was quietly done away with. So I think the big risk here for government is if they don't get this right, or there's severe backlash to it, or it is resulting in people literally being priced out of where they live, this could be very serious for the government.
I'm assuming the other side of it is it's going to be interesting from a landlord perspective, because 4/5-ish of landlords in Ireland have one or two dwellings. They're domestic, yeah. They're homeowners who have a second house. They'll end up in a situation where the house that they're renting out, if it's an existing property in a rent pressure zone, they won't be able to increase their rent. But if they're next door to an apartment block built by a big developer, they will.
Exactly.
Correct.
And so that's, in one way, they're nearly walking into this of their own making, because they're going to either make renters very uneasy and perhaps unhappy if they're eventually being asked to leave their property, or they're having to rent. Like, let's be honest here, if there's a new build apartment going up without rent pressure zone rent caps on it, they're not going to be less than, I'd say, two and a half grand per month. There's no way. There's new apartment blocks going up around Dublin charging up close to 3,000 euro. That's the kind of market rate that we're going to see for these new builds.
But on the other hand, I assume what the government's argument is the apartment builders are saying that with the current rent pressure zone rules, the returns are not high enough for them to put the capital into this construction, so nobody is building apartments.
Yeah, exactly. And they're going to say that this is going to ramp up. I think they want to stimulate the delivery of 25,000 apartments, the Business Post reporting. The issue here is, though, like, and Micheál Martin has said it time and time again, supply, 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 he thinks is going to be the answer. I think there's big question marks over that, because in 2007 we were building more houses than we ever built, and the house prices and all the rest were astronomically high at the time. So it didn't result in the lowering of prices. But the key here is Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil, you'll never hear a minister come out and say they want house prices to fall. Or, you know, because it's not in their interest in terms of their voting base. And that's clear in terms of the base support for those two parties. They are homeowners and mortgage owners. They are not renters.
But this is more tipping around the edges.
Yeah.
I mean, the government has an instinct for the peripheral when it comes to housing. I mean, the political system can be made work. I was a member of a government when the country was bankrupt. There was 500,000 people unemployed and we were locked out of the markets. And simply by deciding that we were confronting a national emergency that concerned the very viability of the state, it was turned around in the space of 5 years. If this government and this Taoiseach, instead of allowing some of his people out to badmouth a new minister, which I think is very unfair, he hardly got his feet under the table before the stories was that he wasn't up to it and he was just a pawn of the Taoiseach who wanted to do it himself. Yeah. I mean, if we acknowledge that we have a housing emergency, and anybody at this stage that doesn't so acknowledge is blind, then the entire weight of the prestige of the Taoiseach's office and of the standing of the Taoiseach should be put behind an emergency plan that is just not about whether we appoint a czar or whether we tip around with the two-tier system. That has to fundamentally look at the issue of supply. I still read bits about those who are so happy that we had a tremendous victory in preventing water charges. All it has done is prevent the existence of a publicly owned utility that could go to the markets to source funds to dig out our water system and service land so that builders could build on it.
And just to expand on that, that's because Irish Water, because it is state-funded, can't access the bond markets and raise its own debt.
That's right.
Yeah.
If, for example, you take the ESB example, the ESB manages its own treasury, goes to the markets itself, raises money for big infrastructure, and so on. We've been deprived of doing that because of the manner in which the water charges were derailed. And it is claimed by people I still talk to as a big victory. They're paying for it out of their income tax. So that, you know, are we serious about this? I mean, 6 months later, a dispute between the minister and the secretary general. I mean, we have this problem now since about 2015. It's a decade. Government after minister after government is being blamed, and of course they're responsible. But what are the senior mandarins in housing doing? I see the SecGen says we don't need a czar. Well, if that's the case, why haven't we ironed out the wrinkles over the last 10 years that it's now perceived that we...
But won't the government point to the Czar and the Housing Activation Office as delivering on exactly what you are raising here? Won't they say, John Cunningham, that effectively what they are doing is getting that, I think you used the word holistic, that holistic approach, that's what the Activation Office is meant to do.
But they have failed in doing so prior to this. And back to your point about this new conversation, think what the HAP scheme has done, which is one level has helped hugely getting people involved, okay? I have a HAP property that's paying half the market rent, okay? So obviously, think about the logic of that. So this contract comes to an end, or I do the year and a half thing and put my son in, whatever else, okay? I can double my rent at the end of that process. But you made the point, Pat, I think, was the biggest thing of all is, where is the bravery and where is the strategic intent? I mean, we've had this conversation before. I sit in the Dublin Chamber Council. And back to the water thing. If they don't fix water in Dublin in the next 5 years, Dublin grinds to a halt. Who's making that big decision now?
This is the total water supply problem. This is the headroom available.
And that's just clean water. Don't mind wastewater. So back to your point, where's the bravery? What I'm hearing again just from people around is that the Taoiseach, Micheál Martin, is incapable of making a decision. Everything has been kicked down and kicked down and kicked down.
But why is the politics of it all not simply... Why is political pressure not functioning? We are told that this government understands that it has effectively the next 4 years to solve this problem, or renders itself unelectable.
2 years, yeah.
So why is that not causing people's minds to sharpen?
I don't understand it. The two major parties of the state lied to us during the general election. They told us that they were going to build about 40,000 houses last year. Now, that was a fairly... Politicians fib and dodge and weave and duck and dive. But that was a pretty big lie, 10,000 out. They seem to be convincing themselves that they're doing everything that is open to them to do. But we're going backwards. 10 years later, we're going backwards. And in those circumstances, if they don't acknowledge that this is the single biggest issue confronting us. I mean, there are other issues coming down the track set us that are not likely to help us in this particular area. But, you know, we'll see how that pans out. But in the interim, they need to sit down, take a strategic approach to how do you ramp up housing output and not be tipping around at the edges.
I think one big political misstep for the new government was they weren't ready to hit the ground running from day one. And the fact that, I know it is perhaps, you know, a bit of a cliche to have like a 100-day target, but they should have been out front and centre from the start of this government with some sort of bigger plan or even something to kind of point to that there was, you know, things going on in the background, that work was underway. But really we have now this Housing for All 2.0 new reset of the housing policy, which is going to be launched in July. Like, my fear is it's going to be in the last days before the summer recess. They'll drop the document and head off, and there's going to be little debate or discussion about whether some of those measures are actually going to create much different. But there's a big responsibility there for them, I think, even politically, for their future, that document has to be radical. It has to have some new ideas. It can't be tinkering around the edges or, you know, touching a few different measures here and there. It has to be something profound, some big ideas, and some very difficult decisions, I'm sure, will have to be made. But I think politically, if they don't get this right in the next couple of years, they'll definitely be feeling it.
It's now or never.
I'll bring you in one second. I just want, there's a couple of interesting texts in relation to what we're talking about in respect to the rent pressure zones, and they reflect some of the points that were being made here. I'm a totally compliant landlord, but I can share a thought with your panel. I had a tenant paying €450 a month rent, and because of his difficult circumstances, I didn't put up his rent. He recently moved to Scotland and so left the apartment. My apartment is in a rent pressure zone. Is it seriously to be suggested that I should now rent that apartment for €450 when the current market rent is €1,200 in my area? Another, I sold my first house last year. I still have four more rental properties. I was waiting to see what the rent pressure zone reform would look like. I will be moving ahead with selling my other houses. No rights for landlords, better investments elsewhere. So if that is the case, that's four properties that are now removed from the rental market by something that's meant to stimulate them.
Yeah, well, some might say it puts it back into private ownership and people can buy it. But the point is, this is the attitude. And I think, again, you made the point earlier on, 80% of property or landowners are one and two house people. That, and you think about it, and the one thing that always irritates me is people talk about the landlord class. Most people, like myself, in trying to protect your future, when you've kind of got a pension that wasn't fit for, you invested in property as the long-term play. But the bottom line is, again, back to the tinkering on the edges, a piece in the Sunday Times today about this issue, about the sale agreed issue, which is really interesting, that, you know, people think they've gone sale agreed, they've got, and obviously, we're holding off here now, and somebody's kind of bid more. And there are other countries.
This is a proposal that sale agreed would be legally binding,
correct.
Surely, though, every sale is subject to contract.
It's subject to contract, but the process that they're doing now is that there's one story that's being told where between deeds and everything else, there was a 2-year gap. And then when it came to the person eventually buying the house, they said, no, the market has shifted and changed, and there's another 80,000 on top of the value. So the sale agreed process is not legally binding, and it leads to one, uncertainty and stress. But again, the point is, that's tinkering around the edges. Who, and if it's not Brendan McDonagh, my understanding ultimately is, within the department, Pat, there are secretaries general who don't get on and don't communicate, and has left this complete gap between housing, finance and whatever else, okay? And they're not solving it together and sitting around the table, because you have to think there's bright enough people inside.
And only the prestige of the Taoiseach will change that.
Yeah, and somebody has to come in and say, this is a crisis and I'm taking control of this, and by the way, we're going to get help. Because this stage now, it's actually so frustrating and irritating. I think there are still talking about it, okay?
This has the feel of, is there anything to be said for another masthead? We cross-departmental group? Task force? Is that where we're
at? But hold on, I don't care what you call it. All I know is that right now, it's not working.
53106, if you want to get in touch, or 087-1400-106. Big thank you to my panel this morning. That's John Cunningham, Relationship Director with Morgan McKinley, Christina Finn from The Journal, and Pat Rabbit, former leader of the Labour Party and chairman of TUSLA.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.